Hello and welcome to this special edition of Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. I'm Catherine Grau. Today we feature two women whose names are synonymous with the Pacific. And the first is this one.
Round Long Pacific, this is la Emmy Radio Australia, Long FM, Mobile.
Hello, Algetana. Welcome, Lord. This is la Triple 10 Minute, Long News, na Current Affairs. Me, Caroline Terriman. Na this is la Emmy Last Pla Week, Blomi, one time Radio Australia, one talk program, lo nem ba mi go malo lo now. That's a long program, lo today.
Caroline Terriman, who first started with the ABC back in the late 1970s, retired earlier this month with plans to head back to her home village in Papua New Guinea's East New Britain province. She saw transformational change in not just the journalism industry in those 40 plus years, but also in PNG and the wider Pacific too, having worked on both the program Pacific Beat and more recently the Tok Pisin One Tok program. As ever, Caro was humbled and even embarrassed by all the attention as she retired. But I managed to convince her to sit down for one more interview. This time, she was on the other side of the microphone to share some of her memories. And we began by talking about why, after telling other people's stories for so long, it's time for her to return to her roots for other storytelling.
The stories that I have shared in the 40 years that I've been in Australia is like for the general public who listen to Radio Australia and things like that. Whereas I haven't spent that time just relaxing and sitting at home, laughing, sharing stories with the families and going and trying to do things that I used to do before I moved to the big smoke in Port Moresby, and then to the biggest smoke in Australia. So I'm just looking forward to doing those things, although things may have changed since I left the village in 1975 or 74 to move to Port Moresby. So I'm just looking forward to those nights sitting in the kitchen, the hut, at home with my sisters and all their kids, my relatives, and just going at night, visiting them too, and telling endless stories that I have missed out on. And maybe they might want to know a little bit about what I've been doing in Australia all these years.
So as you say, for all these years, you've been telling the stories of other people from both PNG and across the Pacific as you've worked on the program Pacific Beats and the Tok Pisin One Tok service as well. What's that responsibility been like for you as a Tolo woman, a woman from Papua New Guinea, working here in Australia, being that link between Australia and the Pacific, telling those some of those stories? Was that a huge responsibility for you?
Yes. It has been a big responsibility because you need to be telling the stories, facts about what has been happening, and to bring them to the listeners, a lot of whom don't have much like what people in the West have. But it's a responsibility that you as a reporter have to tell the right stories. And although sometimes some of those stories are drastic, but you have to tell them as they happened, because people, I guess, would like to know what is happening out there in the little communities, the wider community in PNG and the Pacific region, and internationally. So I think it is a big responsibility that you have.
Obviously, over a career spanning 40-odd years, right from when PNG first got its independence in 1975, you were a young journalist at that stage, still working in Papua New Guinea at the national broadcaster there, at the NBC. And then you touched on the importance of health stories, which I know has been something close to your heart as well. Is it possible in that time of 40-odd years to have a story or a collection of stories that do stand out for you? Was it independence? Did you comprehend the full enormity of what that as a story and for the future of PNG, what that meant? Or is it something entirely different that stands out for you?
Well, I was a young reporter in 1975, and including several of my other colleagues who retired since. But in particular, Kenny Kala, who I worked with, we were just like young reporters and everything was new. But then we realized that, my goodness, what we are broadcasting and reporting on are actually serious issues. And, you know, I was just like gobsmacked thinking, oh my goodness, I don't think I'm fit for this job, because I didn't trust myself at the time. But then as time went on, I began to realize that, yeah, my job is important and that I have to tell the stories that will help people understand things like, in particular, health and development issues, because at that time in 1975, PNG was just like a baby and everything was done by the Australian administration, and things were like, to my young eye, were very smooth, nothing. And then suddenly, after maybe 5-10 years of independence, and some of us were shocked, I guess. Yeah. But one thing, Catherine, I must say that in my career, I've been thinking about and thinking that the service that I've given to the people is during the Bougainville crisis.
Take your time, Caro.
I shouldn't be emotional, but they had nothing. And the ABC, through Radio Australia, the shortwave service was very important, because there was a blackout of information going to Bougainville, and they were like in the dark. They didn't know anything that was happening within Bougainville or PNG or the region or the world, because of the ban on communication. But thank goodness that the ABC, through shortwave radio, they could hear us loud and clear. And, you know, we brought the news, entertainment, and just development stories. And I thought that was, for me, I'm still very proud of that, that we at the ABC brought that very important service to a people who didn't have anything at that time.
And you can see, Caro, that even years on, that still affects you. And it's impossible not to be completely separate as a journalist, while we try, obviously, to do so. When it is your family and your place, your country, that, as you rightly say, it's something that you can be really proud of. Another thing that many people are already commenting as news of your retirement flows through on Facebook and other medium, on radio obviously as well, it's just you being a female in journalism, of course, anywhere in the world, whether it be here in Australia, but particularly in PNG, you broke a lot of ground. You were different and you had to stand up against your mum, in fact, I understand, who wanted you to be married off, have an arranged marriage, have bride price paid, but you and your father thought differently. Do you have any reflections about what it's been? I mean, do you ever stop and think, gosh, I did actually do something special by being particularly a PNG female journalist?
Yes, and thanks to my dear old dad. He helped me run away from my mum. But at the time, he had the vision to say to mum that just because she is a girl, that doesn't mean that she can't do the same thing as her brothers. But anyway, so he helped me run away. And nowadays, you know, sometimes I sit and think, like, Dad, in all his wisdom, decided that he would help me escape Mom. And I thought and I must say that when Mom first visited me in Melbourne, after seeing, you know, the big city and what I was doing, she couldn't even believe I was driving here. And she said, so I said to her, maybe if Dad was alive, I would have liked him to come to enjoy some of this. And she then apologized to me.
Caroline, there's so much we could discuss, but I want to end with some of the messages that have been coming through, that people are sending comments and well wishes to you already. From Jerry Singerock, who you talked about the Bougainville story. He was, of course, a commander of the PNG Defence Force.
I'm retired Major General Jerry Singerock. I was the former commander for Papua New Guinea Defence Force, and I've had the privilege to be interviewed by Carolyn on a series of thematical issues right across the Pacific. I know that the Carolyn's ability to reach out the wider community in the Pacific and Papua New Guinea has always been well received by listeners. And therefore, many times when Carolyn calls me, I always have time to speak to her because it's important to reach out and educate people about current issues, mainly in the security sector.
To Commander Singerock, thank you so much for your kind words. And I'm just so thankful that he, being like, you know, to many Papua New Guineans, he's a big man. And for a little reporter, you know, trying to get a story. And he's always generous with his time and given us stories whenever whether he was busy or not, he would always give us a story. So that's very good.
Another person, Sue Finucane, says, wow, congrats, Caroline Tierman. You are a legend. I still have a debt of gratitude for you. Attached to her Tok Pisin back in 1987 when she went to volunteer in PNG as a very enthusiastic 25-year-old. Thanks so much. It changed my life. Did you know her personally?
No, I didn't. But another friend who used to live in the CPIX in Wewak, told me or asked me to try and give some Tok Pisin lessons to Sue when she was young there, to going for the first time to Papua New Guinea. And so, yeah, I remember. I'm not sure if I gave a good Tok Pisin lesson.
Many other people have said that you were the voice that they listened to as children. Isako Fekawau on Facebook writes, a beautiful voice on the radio I've enjoyed listening to all these years. Salute her to being our voice on ABC Radio Australia. Job well done, Caroline. Another person with a name on Facebook, Pitts KS, said, I grew up listening to her on Radio Australia Pigeon Services News broadcast. That was ages ago. And indeed, Caroline, you feel like
Finis.
James Massa also says, I heard her voice as a young kid growing up. God bless her in her retirement. And another person who finally saw a photo of you says, and the voice does have a face. They've listened to you all these years, but when all other services are out of reach in the remote corners of PNG, there she is on Radio Australia's shortwave frequency, as you said there. Many people from other journalists, Henna Joku, who is a TV journalist in PNG, has said.
My name is Henna Joku. I'm a producer and presenter currently with TV1 in Port Moresby. I grew up listening to NBC. I've always had high admiration, having followed my father into this industry. And having her as a role model, listening to her present was something that I aspired to emulate and become. And the fact that she's lasted so long in the industry is just testament to itself, to her professionalism.
And quite a few others as well suggesting things like formal recognition for being a great ambassador for PNG, Errol Ope says. Donna Lee Rolly says, congratulations, she should be knighted. And Derry Dunner also says she could be recognised by the government for services rendered to the community and people over the years. How does that make you feel?
My goodness, I feel blessed but embarrassed by all these nice words that people are saying. So thank you so much for that. And I've enjoyed bringing you news, entertainment, and, yeah, the likes over all these years. However, I'm heading to Rabaul to just spend time under the stars.
Sounds lovely. Well, thank you. We wish you all the very best. Thank you, Chu. Lukimu.
Lukimu.
Thank you, Caroline.
Ta.
This is Pacific Beat. To another woman whose name is synonymous with the Pacific, Amelia Earhart. She's the pilot who disappeared after taking off from the Papua New Guinean town of Leh back in 1937. The mystery of what happened to her has still not been solved. But it can often seem like every second day or so, someone else has declared that they've solved it. The latest is a project team who've declared they've found the crashed plane off the coast of Bougainville in PNG. After some tensions with locals there, they have now been allowed back to complete another series of dives at what they claim is the wreck site. Now, their claims add to several competing theories about what exactly happened to the doomed aircraft of Amelia Earhart, so our reporter Lauren Beldy thought it was time to revisit some of them.
Roaring into the Oakland airport, she brings to a triumphant finish her 2,400-mile hop from Hawaii after 18 hours in the air.
Chris Williamson is a man who knows a lot about Amelia Earhart. He first learned about her during a history project in grade 3.
That sort of started my unofficial involvement with Amelia Earhart. I did that History Day project. I didn't want it to end. I remember going back a year later in the fourth grade and doing another one. And, you know, I just kept doing them every year all the way up to high school when I started writing papers on her and the ideas became more complex. And I wrote a dissertation on her in college and I just kind of kept going. So she's really always been part of my life. She's always sort of been on that horizon ever since I was a little kid.
He's even moved to her birthplace of Atchison, Tennessee. And for more than 13 years, he and his wife have run Chasing Earhart, a podcast and documentary series dedicated to her life and her legacy. And that involves exploring the theories of what happened to Earhart, her navigator Fred Noonan, and her Lockheed Electra 10E when they took off from Leh in 1937 in an attempt to become the first to fly around the world.
So the facts of the case are these. So they were in Leh, New Guinea, okay, so they were three quarters of the way around the world. So they had started out on the morning of July the 2nd, 1937, they took off from Leh, New Guinea, that roughly three quarters of the way through their equatorial world flight. So at this point in the trip, they're 22,000 miles in with just over 7,000 miles to go to get to California. And standing in the way of California and them is 2,556 miles of ocean from Leh, New Guinea to Howland Island. And this was to be their final refueling point before returning to Hawaii.
The flight was rough. There were strong headwinds and the radio communications were poor.
As they near Howland, it's believed that the Electra was down to her last 97 gallons of fuel, roughly. That's debated, but that's as close as we can get to official capacity. There's a Coast Guard cutter, Itasca. That's a small ship that lies in wait off the coast of Howland Island, and it's there to help guide Amelia and Noonan in once they come into sight. And it's believed that all's well because the signal strength readings from the Electra, they keep getting stronger and stronger as she apparently gets closer and closer to the Itasca. There's a gentleman on the boat. He's the last person to actually speak to Earhart alive. His name is Leo Bellarts. He was the chief radio man on the Itasca. And he testifies to the fact that he thought she was so close that he stepped outside the radio booth to look for her plane. He thought he would see it. He thought he would hear it. I mean, he just thought they were right on top of them.
But they never did make it to Howland Island.
July 7th, 5 days later, USS Colorado begins to search the waters to the southeast of Howland. The Lexington arrives on the scene soon after from its base in San Diego to join the party. They all kept searching until around July 18th, and to this day, neither Amelia Earhart, Fred Noonan, or their plane have ever been found.
What happened after that has been debated for more than 80 years.
There are five main theories to what happened. The first theory is what I just explained to you. It's the official representation of the United States government. It's what they stand behind to this day. She simply ran out of fuel, fell short of her destination of Howland Island, and the plane lies 18,000 feet down, and it's in relatively good shape, depending on who you listen to. The second theory, and one of the more prominent ones out there, is known as Japanese capture.
Famous aviatrix Amelia Earhart was beginning a program of air research that ended with her mysterious disappearance in the Pacific. A theory has always been that she wandered off course and landed near Truk, where the Japanese had secret military installations. She may have been executed.
The theory goes that Noonan and Earhart were captured by the Japanese and ended up on Saipan. And that's where different people believe different things. Some think they died or were executed there, but others believe in something called the Irene Bolam hypothesis.
The Irene Bolam hypothesis states that she does make it off of Saipan and she does return. After being in Japanese captivity for some time, Amelia Earhart's liberated and she's repatriated back to the United States. And some people believe that it was done in secret with the help of FDR, with the help of Jackie Cochran, who was her dear friend and who founded the WASP program. There's also some information, some stuff that we've uncovered that we haven't really fleshed out yet, but there's also rumor and innuendo that Howard Hughes was actually involved financing her repatriation. She was declared dead in absentia in 1939 on January 5th, 1939. Because of that, she was for all intents and purposes dead. Amelia Earhart assumed the identity of Irene Bolam, and she lived out her remaining days on the east coast of the United States, and she never flew again.
There's also the castaway theory, that the duo landed on another island called Niki Mororo and lived out the rest of their lives there. And then there's the theory that underscores the Blue Angel Project, the belief that they turned back towards PNG and crashed off the coast of Bougainville.
The idea there is, after realizing that they weren't going to make their intended destination of Howland Island, Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan made the executive decision to turn back and head for the nearest available runway, which was in turn Buka Island. And they encountered a storm, and after lightning struck their aircraft, according to a witness, a little kid that was on the island at the time, they crash landed off the shores of Buka Island, and the plane now rests there to this day in less than 100 feet of clear blue Pacific. And of course, that's an ongoing investigation.
Each theory, says Williamson, has its own evidence. Irene Bolam knew an incredible amount about planes, despite never having flown in her life. Some claim to have found bones on Niki Mororo that don't belong to Pacific Islanders, and others have produced photographs that appear to show Earhart on Saipan after the crash. But the Blue Angel Project are the only ones who have already got a plane wreck to work with.
I think somebody has cracked this case, and I think it's a matter of really at this point, when, you know, I think it's just a matter of when. I think whether Bill Snavely is onto something in Buka is very, very possible. This is the only man that's ever had time, distance, and fuel all correct. And he's the only man in 80 plus years that actually has an aircraft, which is pretty incredible. And the aircraft happens to be in 100 feet of water. And it happens to share some consistencies with the plane that she flew. Granted, there was a handful of planes that were very similar to the L-10E, but it happens to be consistent. And it's an aircraft and it's an aircraft site that's been screaming at people to investigate it for many, many years. And that's what they're finally getting to do, which is really remarkable. He may be onto something. He may actually have cracked this thing.
But Chris Williamson also says that in a way, it doesn't matter if the mystery is ever solved.
Maybe it doesn't matter what happened to Amelia Earhart. Maybe it doesn't matter who finds her. Maybe it doesn't matter what the ending is. Maybe it doesn't matter how she died. Maybe it only matters how she lived. And that's what's the most important thing to talk about. And I think that's one of the things that we've really been pushing for with Chasing Earhart, is this woman's impact and this woman's legacy.
It's much easier to fly the Atlantic Ocean now than it was a few years ago. I expect to be able to do it in my lifetime again.
In 1935, this is a woman that went to Purdue University and was talking about STEM. She was talking about STEM before STEM was ever even a thing, before it was ever even dreamed up. She was telling women, you can be engineers, you can be scientists, you can be aviators, you can be mathematicians, you can do what you want to do. This is a woman that could stop and bend down and tell a little, you know, 10-year-old girl at the time, you can be anybody you want to be. Go out there and do what you want. And that 10-year-old girl would grow up to be an engineer and work at NASA. What's really interesting about this case, it's like a double-edged sword, because you've got this woman who lived for 39 years and was this worldwide famous explorer and was this incredible and passionate aviatrix who did all these things and broke all these rules and broke all these records and just was the face of aviation. And then she just disappears into thin air.
It's Chris Williamson from Chasing Earhart speaking there to Lauren Beldy. Well, that is all for this special Pacific Review. I'm Catherine Grau. Thanks for listening.